Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals WebEx hearings. This is our final oral argument for today. The panel is comprised of myself, Judge Renee Werke as presiding judge, Judge Francis Connolly, and Judge Tracy Smith. The same rules apply with WebEx hearings. Please introduce yourself and state which party you're speaking on behalf of before you begin your argument. With that said, I will call A20-0103, Matthew Hartley, as the appellant versus State of Minnesota. And appellant counsel, when you're ready to proceed, you may do so.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Evan Weiner, and I represent the appellant, Matthew Hartley, in this matter. Appellant's post-conviction petition is based in large part on evidence that was not part of the original district court record on direct appeal. Therefore, the post-conviction petition is not barred by the NAFLA rule, and the district court erred by denying the post-conviction petition without a hearing. In the Torres case, which we cited in our brief, the Minnesota Supreme Court said a claim of ineffective assistance of trial counsel is not barred by NAFLA if it cannot be determined from the district court record and requires additional evidence, such as that involving attorney-client communications. In the Leak case, which we also cited in our brief, the court said a claim of ineffective assistance of trial counsel cannot be resolved on the trial court record alone. It need not be brought in a direct appeal and may be brought in a post-conviction petition. And in the Reed case, which the state cites in its brief, the Minnesota Supreme Court said the NAFLA rule bars a post-conviction ineffective assistance of counsel claim if the claim is based solely on the trial record and the claim was known or should have been known on direct appeal. So it is clear that NAFLA only bars claims for ineffective assistance of counsel where the claim is based solely on the trial court record. And the reason for that is because, of course, on direct appeal, we're not allowed to introduce any new evidence. So if there is new evidence in support of the ineffective assistance claim, it has to be brought in a post-conviction proceeding and rather than on direct appeal, and that is the case here. For example, we have the expert testimony of Dr. Eisner regarding the likely effects of the medical issue that trial counsel experienced. That was not part of the record on direct appeal and could not have been. If, you know, had we tried to introduce that on direct appeal, the court would have stricken it from the record because we would not be allowed to introduce such new evidence on direct appeal. We also have Mr. Hartley's post-conviction affidavit regarding what occurred off the record during plea negotiations and during trial, as well as his own observations of his counsel's condition during the trial, which would not necessarily have shown up in the transcripts. We also have Callan Blake's affidavit regarding his observations of trial counsel's condition during the trial, which again included material that wouldn't be part of the transcripts. There was also the exhibit to Mr. Hartley's affidavit, which is the questions that the defense's consulting accident reconstructionist gave to defense counsel to ask the state's reconstructionist. That was not part of the record on direct appeal. The police report showing that video footage existed at Captain Black's bar, and that was not subpoenaed. That was not part of the trial court record. Dr. Eisner also gave an opinion about the likely effects of the victim's blood alcohol level of 0.273. That expert opinion was not part of the record on direct appeal. And also on remand with an evidentiary hearing, we would have the benefit of trial counsel's testimony and the trial prosecutor's testimony about what happened during plea negotiations, what happened during trial, you know, as far as trial counsel, what the effects of this health issue were on him on direct appeal. So this case should be remanded for an evidentiary hearing on the issue of whether Mr. Hartley had ineffective assistance of counsel during plea negotiations and or during trial. The post-conviction statute is clear that a petition for post-conviction relief may only be denied where the files and records of the proceedings can only be denied without a hearing. I mean, can only when the files and records of the proceeding conclusively show that the petitioner is entitled to no relief, and that's certainly not the case here. as to there's ample evidence in post-conviction record to justify an evidentiary hearing here. As to the plea negotiations, it's clearly established there's a Sixth Amendment right to effective assistance of counsel during plea negotiations. The Leak case that we cited in our brief, and then this court's decision in Johnson from last year, which we also cited in our brief, show that it's very important that a defendant be accurately advised of the statutory maximum sentence during plea negotiations. Now, the cases do differ in that Leak, the defendant rejected a plea based on an understatement of what the maximum sentence was. So he decided to go to trial because he was told that the maximum sentence was less than what it was. He lost at trial and got a higher sentence than he thought he could get. In Johnson, the defendant took a plea based on an overstatement of what he might get if he lost at trial. He was threatened with a sentence that was more than what was authorized by law. He took a plea. That plea was vacated by this court. In Mr. Hartley's case, he was unable to engage in effective plea negotiations because he was never advised of the actual maximum sentence. And so he went to trial and lost without ever having had an opportunity to engage in meaningful plea negotiations. In this case, the statutory maximum sentence for the offense with which Mr. Hartley was charged was 10 years. He received the statutory maximum sentence after he was convicted at trial. But prior to trial, the state's offer was 150 months. And then at a settlement conference just before trial, they offered a range of 142 and a half to 166 and a half months. Those offers were greater than the statutory maximum sentence. What appears to have happened here is that the state thought that Mr. Hartley had a qualified prior impaired driving offense within 10 years, which would have made the maximum sentence 180 months. The state's offer was 150 months, 30 months less than what they thought the maximum, apparently thought the maximum was. Mr. be willing to agree to a sentence of 90 months, that his trial counsel said that he had conveyed that offer to the prosecutor and that the prosecutor had rejected that and come back with the 150-month offer. Now, there may be a factual dispute that would need to be addressed on remand as to what actually was said between Mr. Hartley and his trial counsel or between trial defense counsel and the prosecutor. However, it appears likely, at least on this record, without having had an evidentiary hearing, that if the prosecutor had known that the statutory maximum counsel, was 120.
Does the record indicate that prior to trial, your client would have accepted 90 months?
Yes, in his affidavits, in Mr. Hartley's post-conviction affidavit, he states that he told his trial counsel had told him that he had conveyed that offer to the prosecutor, that the prosecutor had rejected the 90-month offer and come back with 150 months. It appears likely that because the state was, typically the state is willing to offer some discount, if you will, off of the statutory maximum sentence to avoid a trial, it appears that the state believed the maximum was the 180 months and they were willing to offer 150. It seems likely that if trial counsel had pointed out that the maximum was 120, they would have accepted Mr. Hartley's 90-month offer. It appears likely on this record, and at the very least, an evidentiary hearing is warranted on this issue. We also think an evidentiary hearing is warranted as to the health issue, trial counsel's health issue. We have the medical expert testimony of Dr.
Mr. Weiner, does the record indicate, I mean, I understand how you got to 90 and that, you know, 120 minus 30 is 90, but does the record indicate, I mean, that assumes they would have, you know, offered you another 30-month discount. Does the record indicate sort of, well, that's what they always do, you know, up in Scott County or down in Scott County, I guess. You know, they always sort of take 30 months off and, you know, that's how we start the ball rolling. I mean, I don't know.
On this phase of the proceeding, we don't have any evidence of that other than the fact that they were willing to offer 30 months off of what they appear to have thought was the maximum. But again, we haven't had an evidentiary hearing yet. So We've done the best we could with what is available to us. But if there were an evidentiary hearing, I suspect the trial prosecutor would testify. You know, it is telling that in opposition to this post-conviction petition, they didn't submit any affidavit from the trial prosecutor saying, no, we wouldn't have offered anything off of the 120 maximum if we had known that the maximum was, in fact, 120. They relied entirely on NAFLA. The district court's decision relied entirely on NAFLA. So at this phase of the proceeding, the only evidence that we have been able to adduce is the fact that they apparently offered 30 months less than what they thought the maximum was. On remand, we would want an evidentiary hearing on that. We would want the trial prosecutor to testify as to that and be subject to cross-examination.
So what you're saying then, Mr. Weiner, is that had his counsel been effective, he would have got a better deal offered?
That's
what you're trying to maintain as far as ineffective assistance?
Yeah, as to the ineffective assistance to counsel during plea negotiations, that is our contention. We are also bringing claims for ineffective assistance of counsel during trial because of this health issue that happened during trial and also because of the various trial-related errors that we pointed out in our post-conviction petition, such as the failure to ask the questions of the state's accident reconstructionist that the defense's consulting accident reconstructionist gave to the defense in advance. This was clearly a key part of the defense strategy, was the cross-examination of the state's accident reconstructionist. Much of the state's case hinged on the testimony of the state's accident reconstructionist. Arguably, he was the state's most important witness. During opening statement, defense counsel, trial counsel, stated to the jury that the cross-examination of the state's accident reconstructionist would be particularly important. Mr. Hartley's post-conviction affidavit talks about how important this cross-examination was to the defense. And if you look at the list of questions that's attached as Exhibit A to Mr. Hartley's post-conviction affidavit and compare that with the transcript, you'll see that Mr. Miller did not ask any any of the questions that were listed in that consulting expert's recommendation.
Counsel, may I ask about the cross-examination of the expert? On direct appeal, wouldn't an appellate court be able to look at the actual cross-examination and determine whether it met an objective standard of reasonableness and whether or not other questions were asked? I mean, how do you avoid the issue of that's a strategic question and the fact that the cross-examination that was conducted is available on direct appeal on the record?
The transcript of the cross-examination was available on direct appeal. However, the list of questions that they had gotten from the consulting expert was not part of the record on direct appeal. In fact, even that the fact that there was a consulting defense reconstruction expert was not part of the record on direct appeal. So to really evaluate that claim, a court would need to know that there was a defense consulting expert. We need to know what the proposed questions by that expert were. We need to know that this was a central part of the defense. We need to know that during the break, the transcript of the proceeding shows that there was a break that occurred during the cross-examination so that Mr. Hartley could speak with his defense counsel. Mr. Hartley's post-conviction affidavit clarifies what was discussed during that break, where basically he could tell that his counsel was struggling, was not in good condition, and brought up the fact that, hey, why aren't you asking these questions that were a key part of our strategy that our expert recommended we ask? His counsel said something to the effect of, I'll get my stuff together, I'll ask these questions, and then never did. In order to evaluate the effectiveness of the cross-examination, a reviewing court needs to know all of that, in addition to just being able to read the transcript of the questions that were asked. Similarly, you know, with the other trial errors, a reviewing court would need to know what a blood alcohol expert would have testified to had one been called. Our post-conviction record includes what Dr. Eisner, a physician, would say about a 0.273 blood alcohol. A reviewing court would need to know that there was, in fact, video of Captain Black's bar had video footage, and that police report wasn't part of the record on direct appeal. We brought it in for the purposes of post-conviction. A reviewing court would need to know that Mr. Hartley asked his counsel to request a careless driving lesser included offense instruction, and that his counsel said he would and never did that. That wasn't part of the record on direct appeal. We made it part of the record. We've supplemented records that could have refuted the allegation that Mr. Hartley was already in Elko at 8:30 or 9:30 p.m. drinking. He had health record, cell phone records, rather, that could have refuted that, but it never got in because his counsel did not lay the proper foundation. We've supplemented the record to include the record on direct appeal, and there's ample evidence to justify an evidentiary hearing in this matter, and we ask that the court remand for an evidentiary hearing. Thank you.
Thank you.
My time is up.
You have your 5 minutes for a rebuttal. Turn to you, Mr. Zettler.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Todd Zettler. I represent respondent, state of Minnesota. We'll largely rely on the brief and would certainly take any questions that the court may have. The question in this case really is whether the post-conviction court abused its discretion in denying relief in this case. And under CNAFLA, according to Torres, which is the case, primary case cited by appellant, all claims brought or known on direct appeal are barred from consideration in a collateral proceeding. So that's the general rule. All claims known on direct appeal are barred in a collateral proceeding. And so in this case, all of these claims were known. So they are barred by CNAFLA unless they meet an exception. And there are two exceptions. So really what we're talking about here is whether the exception is met. And the post-conviction court correctly discusses this. The second exception is whether a claim is not barred where the petitioner did not deliberately and inexcusably fail to raise the claim on direct appeal, and fairness requires its consideration. So under that second exception, that's where courts can address ineffective assistance of trial counsel claims. So Torres states, under the second exception, we have held that a claim of ineffective assistance of trial counsel is not barred by CNAFLA if it can be determined from the district court record and requires additional evidence, such as having attorney-client communications. Attorney-client communications are not necessary in this case to decide these issues. So these are CNAFLA barred. Number one, Hartley never indicated on the record an interest in pleading guilty, either before trial or after trial. Judge Connolly, you asked about whether he ever interest in pleading guilty. None.
Well, counsel, on a post-conviction petition, accepting what, for purposes of determining whether it can go forward, the affidavit from the petitioner says that he conveyed right 3 months. And looking at that and looking at what the state offered and what could reasonably be, I guess, inferred to be a mistake about what the maximum, or excuse me, what the presumptive was, how is that something that our court previously on the direct appeal could have reviewed, whether there was a communication of the what the appellant would agree to and whether his counsel failed to try and sort out the issue about the presumptive sentence?
Even if you take that as true, the prosecution would never have agreed to a 90-month sentence. There's nothing in the record that would establish that. 90 months would be 5 months downward durational departure.
Right. Well, that gets into the substantive question of whether they could prove it at a post-conviction hearing. But the question we're dealing with is whether our court could have reviewed that question on a direct appeal such that a later raising of it should be barred, procedurally barred. And so how is it procedurally barred, something that could have and should have been raised on a direct appeal? It seems like it includes things outside of the trial record.
It doesn't, because you don't need to have attorney-client communications. You can look at simply the facts as they are. You can accept as true what he says, and it still does not lead to post-conviction relief in this case. The prosecution would never have accepted it, would never have come off the mandatory maximum sentence in this case, which was the 120 months. In fact, the state filed at sentencing, and it was titled, state's memorandum in opposition to any sentence less than the maximum. The state, I mean, first of all, if I back up, settlement was never an issue in this case. It was never really discussed. This was not a defendant who was going to plead guilty. He never indicated that to anybody contemporaneously. He never indicated that in the PSI. He never indicated that in the judge, in the letter he sent to the judge after the conviction and before sentencing. So there's plenty of contemporaneous evidence that indicates he had zero interest in resolving this case. But even if you accept that as true for purposes of the post-conviction, he still is barred because he knew of it at the time and did not raise it. And you could have reviewed it because 90 months would not have done anything in this case. The state would never have settled this for anything less. There's not any kind of, to go to Judge Connolly's question, there's not any kind of a Scott County starts off with a downward departure offer. This is a criminal vehicular homicide. This is an exceptionally serious case. And there was no offer to settle it.
Anything. But you're saying we could have, on the first appeal, the direct appeal, we as an appellate court could have decided that the state would never have offered 90 months? That we would make that factual? Doesn't that sound like a factual finding? Or what is that? How would we do that on a direct appeal?
Well, it would be in the context of, based upon what they're raising, was it ineffective assistance of counsel? And it wasn't. If you to look that, so because it wasn't, it would be procedurally barred. It can be, it could have been addressed on the first appeal. That's the question. Not whether it would have ultimately, there's not.
Right. Could it have been raised and established on a record that exists on direct appeal? And it seems to me you've been saying, well, the record that exists on direct appeal would have shown us, I guess, that the state would never have accepted or offered 90. And so therefore, prove ineffective assistance of counsel. And it's that first step that the record on appeal the state would or would not have done. I'm not sure what that record on direct appeal would have told us relative to that question.
Well, the record on direct appeal would have included all of the state's arguments, the sentencing arguments, the memorandum in opposition to anything less than the statutory maximum. It would have included Hartley's letter to the court, where he's not taking responsibility. It would have included the pre-sentence investigation that recommended the statutory maximum because of Hartley's deplorable performance on probation. All of that would have been in the record on direct appeal and was in the record on direct appeal.
Following up on Judge Schmidt's excellent question, so what you're saying is it doesn't matter if he now says, well, I would have taken 90 if, you know, 90 was offered. You're saying that there is no indication in the record that the state ever would have offered 90, period. So therefore, he can't say I would have taken 90 because that depends on whether he would have offered it. And there's nothing in the record where the record is silent indicating that, oh, yeah, the state would have offered 90. Is that how you want us to resolve Judge Smith's question?
I think for the purposes of where we are, if you have to assume that what he said is true in his post-conviction affidavit, right? Now, granted, the state does not agree that anything in his affidavit is true, but that would have been for a hearing that we didn't have and that they're asking for. So purposes of post-conviction now on appeal, if you assume that to be true, that he told his lawyer he would have taken 90, there is no indication anywhere that the state would have offered a downward durational departure. And in fact, all of the evidence is to the contrary.
You know, I had another question. Counsel for the appellant sort of went on and on about how, well, you know, we didn't ask these, you know, there wasn't any testimony about the accident, or there wasn't any cross-examination of the state's accident reconstruction witness. There wasn't anything about the blood alcohol. I mean, is any of that relevant because he was acquitted of the vehicular homicide drunk driving charge and that we're left with the other two? I mean, is this just irrelevant?
I believe it is, yes. And it also is, and particularly these next two issues. So I think you have a difference between the sentencing issue and then these other two clearly trial issues. These trial issues are simply repackaged claims that they already made on direct appeal. They lost substantively, and now they're claiming that it's ineffective assistance in order to try to put a filter on it and get a different result. But substantively, they raised these issues on direct appeal. So they were known, they were raised, and they are now CNAF LaBarred. And that's exactly what Torres versus State says. So they don't meet any exception. And the post-conviction court correctly, in fact, characterized them as simply repackaging previously lost claims. That's what this is. And this isn't even claiming ineffective assistance of appellate counsel, which is the one way that they typically try to get around a bar of ineffective assistance of trial counsel claims. They're not claiming that. They're straight claiming ineffective assistance of trial counsel for essentially the same claims that they've already brought substantively and lost on direct appeal. That's procedurally barred.
You know, what was the evidence that he was guilty of criminal vehicular homicide gross negligence? I'm not talking about leaving the scene. I mean, and if you throw out the alcohol, what's the evidence of that?
Well, this court laid, not this exact court, but the Court of Appeals laid it out succinctly in the direct appeal.
Court, and I believe I was the author. Thank you.
It was then, the court's familiar with the facts, obviously. He left the bar late at night, driving the opposite lane, raining out, driving a big Harley, 60 miles an hour, opposite lane of traffic, driving, weaving past people walking home from a party at 2 a.m. That's the gross negligence. Unless the court has any other questions, I would ask this court to affirm post-conviction court.
Thank you. Turn back to appellate counsel. Can wait just a minute. We're going to have to get the timer going. And there you go.
Your Honors, this needs to be remanded for an evidentiary hearing because on this record, there is no way that this court could find that that had the true statutory maximum sentence been raised during plea negotiations, it would have had no impact. Counsel for the state argues that, but that's not evidence, that's argument. There's no evidence in the record that it would have had no impact at all.
My name is Jeff Carlson, I'm assistant attorney general.
My apologies. There's no evidence in the record that it would have had no
impact. Let me ask you this. I mean, all of this depends, or a lot of it depends on, would he have taken 90 prior to trial? And are you saying that the way we know that is because of his post-conviction affidavit? That's the only reason we know that, right?
Correct. And he would, of course, be subject to cross-examination on that as well.
Right. But I mean, but there's nothing in the record. You know, there's no emails back and forth saying, well, you know, he might take 90. I mean, because that seems to me to be important. I mean, if there was no indication prior to trial, and, you know, I mean, I know what his affidavit says, but what I'm interested is sort of what everybody was thinking pre-trial. If there's no indication he would ever have taken 90, then who cares that he would have been offered 90? And I guess I am sort of, as a matter of common sense and just sort of trying to get to the truth, I'm always interested in what people would do before trial, not what they say they would have done after trial when they're now facing a bigger sentence. So is there anything else in the record besides his affidavit indicating he would have taken 90 pre-trial?
No, there is nothing in the record at this point on that issue. But however, that's a fact issue, and it's a credibility determination to be made on remand. He would be subject to cross-examination, and the issue of pre-trial versus post-trial and what the party's position was, that cuts both ways. The counsel for the state points to the fact that the state demanded the maximum sentence after trial, after they had obtained a conviction, but that does not mean that before trial they wouldn't have offered less than that in order to avoid a trial. So that cuts both ways. It would be a factual issue to be addressed on remand, and it has to be addressed on remand. Likewise, with the health counsel's health issue and the expert testimony on that, you know, it's very telling that if you look at the decision on direct appeal, by the way, these issues we're raising now are separate than what we did on direct appeal, but there is an overlap with our request for a mistrial on direct appeal, where we did bring up the health issue first, a conviction based on trial counsel's Alzheimer's disease. And this court in the direct appeal said, when distinguishing the Pilchak case, the quote, the practical and relevant differences between one lawyer's ulcer and another's mentally debilitating disease are self-evident. And on the record on direct appeal, the panel decided that, but Dr. Eisner's medical expert testimony in post-conviction shed some additional light on what the cognitive effects of an ulcer like this would be. So it's important that there be an evidentiary hearing on these medical issues that were raised in the post-conviction proceeding, on these trial errors that were raised in the post-conviction proceeding, and on these plea negotiation issues that were raised during... I'm sorry, my computer keeps starting up an audio thing. Your Honors, we would ask that this be remanded for an evidentiary hearing. The district court erred in dismissing this based on NAFLA. This is based on additional evidence that needs to be heard on the merits. So we would ask that this court reverse and remand for a hearing on the merits. Thank you, Your Honors, for your time.
Thank you to both attorneys for participating in this fashion for hearing purposes. The matters are taken under advisement. A decision will be issued within the statutory time frame. Judges, we will adjourn and discuss our case resolutions.